Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, if you would like to hear prior shows, the last 5 shows are archived on the website, and then the rest of them, including the last 5 shows, are archived on the radio station at www.blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Okay, now let's get started. You know what? We get lots and lots of emails of people telling us that really what we're doing is we're talking about parenting skills practically. And so it's kind of like, well, you have to have the same skills as a parent does in order to successfully host a meeting between diverse parties so that they can accomplish a common goal and keep focused. And, you know, that got me to thinking, and I was thinking, well, what parenting traits are required to be a successful facilitator? I think will be our first question this evening. What parenting traits do we need? And look, I already see lots of people. Thank you very much for your participation. I see lots of people. Oh, we've got a lot of people saying the word patience. Patience is needed in order to be a successful host, a successful facilitator, a successful mediator to get everyone to focus and move forward towards the common goal. Patience. Now, what type of patience are we talking about? Harmony says that you need the patience of Job. And, you know, you must have a lot of experience, Harmony. And others are agreeing that I know that this is a global show and we're not all in the Judeo-Christian religion. We all know that Job is the biblical figure whom God tested the patience of through a series of trials. And Job was successful and he was rewarded by God because he had a tremendous amount of patience and faith and humility. So, yes, it's kind of like, what kind of patience? Well, the patience of Job is an expression. And, yes, I suppose that's true. You do need a lot of patience, and you can't lose your temper. We talk about that sometimes on these shows, and we talk about the fact that someone has to stay reasonable and practical, and that you can't just lose your temper, even if someone else in the room has done so. You must call a timeout. You must do something to get them from making the entire process unacceptable. And that's one of the reasons that Recipe for Peace Now uses the food. It's not because we're hungry, really, and we're not serving dinner, although we might be. But the real reason is because the food is a gentle distraction, a way of turning the meeting around so that it doesn't become animosity and you don't have fighting. Because that will get us nowhere, of course. We need to keep pushing forward towards the common goal. And, you know, Mike's making an interesting point, and others too. A lot of people have agreed with Harmony and the concept of the patience of Job. And I think I agree with you too, yes. And Mike and several other people have said that you need to let everyone voice their opinions and concerns, which means that you must give plenty of time for the process. Yes, I think that's true, too, and we've got quite a bit of agreement that in order to really get somewhere, especially if there are diverse viewpoints, it's going to take some time, and oftentimes more meetings, more time, more patience than we really thought it would. Because sometimes we think the people are, the issues are closer than they really are when you're reaching for a pragmatic goal, a pragmatic solution to something. Sometimes the participants in the process are further apart than we think they are. And so one must leave plenty of time. And that, I think, goes with patience, doesn't it? Yes, I see a lot of agreement that time is patience. That's the whole idea. Well, I don't know that they're synonymous with each other, because you can spend time and not have any patience. So it's a trait that one must develop. And, you know, I've got quite a few people that are kind of disagreeing in a way. And Brady states it rather well. He says it's possible to be too patient and slow the process to a crawl, and then it will halt and you can't restart the process of reaching accord, and the whole thing collapses. It's too much patience, too slow, too much time. And I'm getting some agreement with that, yes, and I'm getting some discussion that it is not too much patience. It is, well, I'm going to call it lack of control, lack of focus. It is perhaps the host's duty, but perhaps someone else in the group can facilitate this. And we were not the only facilitators. We've talked about the fact that although there is usually one person or few people that are getting the group together, and it's usually us, because we are the people that are the most skilled, of course, because we've talked about these things and we have an idea where we're going. And oftentimes it's a person with some experience. Although there is a person who is in name the host, and it might even be really the person whose home it is, whose facility it is, who made the food. I mean, you can be the host for a variety of reasons. Although we talk as though there is one person that is playing this role, in all truth, and I see this, a lot of people comment on this, everyone in the room is a facilitator of the process. So, and yes, I see that someone has already finished my sentence. My goodness, I'm getting predictable. And so we all must be patient with each other. Yes, Grace has finished my sentence. Thank you. We all must be patient with each other, because we are all facilitators. We are all, everyone in the room is there to reach the common goal. How they reach it is the question. And how long? Yes, people are saying how long. You know what? I'm getting quite a few people asking how long the process should take. And yes, I'm going, and other people are going, I know what you're going to say. Yes, I'm going to say the sentence or the phrase that I've been accused of saying lots on this show. And I'm going to say it depends, because it does. Sometimes if the parties really are not very far apart and the goal is well-defined, fairly evident, well-defined, if the goal is well-defined, it won't take very long. We can do it in a single meeting. We can find out that we've got connections in common, that we have goals in common, that we can delegate some duties, and we've got the process going. We're off to a running start. So it could not take very long at all. Sometimes, if the parties are further apart than they seem, or they might seem very far apart, I see people are saying that it's not a question, they don't even seem close together, or the issues are complicated, or there's more than one issue that needs to be resolved, it could take a while. you have to think about what it is you're doing and how complicated, and I suppose, and people are saying that the main thing you have to take into account is the personalities of the people involved. It might take some doing and a few meetings and some emailing up and back, and the process may be more extensive. But you know, when you get to reach the accord, oftentimes that kind of accord will last because there's been a lot of work put into it. And so it depends how complicated. I can't really say how long it takes for to get the common goal accomplished, to reach accord, because you don't know that even when you're starting out. Even if you know the parties fairly well, even if you think that it's going to be fairly straightforward, it might not be. You don't know until you get into it. So I always say, plan for extra time. Plan for extra meetings. Plan for a more complicated act, and then you'll be pleasantly surprised if it all comes together in one sitting, and you go, wow, we're really good at this. We can handle this. I've listened to the Recipe for Peace Now show for a long time. Oh, just kidding, but I hope that you have. And thank you all for all of your participation. I love hearing from you. And so it's possible to be too patient. It's a good point. It's possible to get bogged down and let too many people have too much time to, well, I see a lot of people saying that they can't just keep repeating themselves. It takes too much time and everyone loses patience, right? And when you've got something where the participants are getting tied up in their own side and the presentations are getting redundant and everybody's heard it. You know the expression, trying everybody's patience? The old expression that means that you're really coming, everybody's losing patience. You're trying the patience of everyone else too. And that's counterproductive, isn't it? And yes, Gavin makes a good point that if you try the patience of the participants too much, they won't come back. And your process will collapse because you won't get any participation. They're going to say, well, it's taking forever. We're not reaching any kind of a conclusion. And did you ever see a debate that has a moderator and the moderator's not very good and they don't really keep the people on topic and they don't keep them to their time and the rules are not clearly defined. Remember, we've talked in prior programs about clearly defined rules of how we take the floor, how long we talk, who gets a turn when. See, these are all important, but they must be indeed enforced. So, yes, patience. Now, let's look for some other traits, because I've got lots of votes for all kinds of traits. And I think patience was number one. And I suppose that this is similar to patience, but not really the same. Another rather parenting trait that we are going to talk about to nurture success, and that's what parents do, isn't it? They nurture success. Another parenting trait is tolerance. Tolerance. And Grace says that, and other people they're saying this too, that you have not only need tolerance, but you need to accommodate human frailty. Everyone has faults and unreasonable opinions. You know what? I think that's true. And I see quite a few people using, I see a lot of you when it said tolerance, you're saying that you need to be able to deal with stupidity and meanness. Yeah, stupidity and meanness. Well, I suppose there's tolerance in dealing with that. But, of course, when we have someone who is being Well, it's a question of judgment, of course. But if we're having someone who is being bigoted or hurtful or stereotypical towards the other people or the issues, and we've talked about bigotry and unreasonableness in prior shows, of course, but if we have someone that is doing that deliberately to disrupt the process, just like it's possible to be too patient, it is probably possible to be too tolerant, and they must be prevented from disrupting the process. And, you know, several people are asking what makes an opinion unreasonable and who is the judge? Who judges whether we've got stupidity here? And who judges whether the opinions are reasonable and not just completely off the wall? And I've got some people that are voting for the host. Brian says the host is third-party impartial, is the person who judges that. And they judge it whether or not the opinion is based on facts. Facts. Well, first of all, and we've got a lot of people with disagreement, and thank you for all for your participation. I think it's best. Now, the host is the third party impartial, right? Right. Now, you might not be, of course. You might belong to one of the sides and have a real strong opinion on the issues, and you're the host because it's your facility or something. But it is the host's responsibility, in our context at least, to attempt to act reasonably and to get others to act reasonably also. And meanness, I'll assume, is just being nasty and rude. And that, as we have discussed in prior shows, will not be tolerated. You use peer pressure. You use rules that you set out ahead of time. You use timeouts, which is one of the reasons that we have the food. And you use the various tricks. And did I mention, I believe I do at the beginning, that if you would like to hear prior shows where we have talked about that particular issue more extensively, the prior shows are archived on the website, the last five, on www.recipeforpeacenow.com, and the rest of the shows, in fact, including those five, all the shows, are archived on the radio station at blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. So meanness, we're not going to tolerate. Stupidity is an opinion, right? People are saying, no, it's not an opinion. Well, it kind of is an opinion. And we're going to get back to the concept of based on facts. You know, Brian said that you know when something is a really stupid and just shouldn't be tolerated for a long period of time, an opinion, if it is not based on facts. But, you know, Melanie and others, quite a few people are making a point that sometimes opinions, in fact, with some frequency, opinions and taking a side on an issue and how to go forward, what you do with it and what you think is really based on long-standing cultural or faith-based bias and ideas. And that's what you need to acknowledge and understand, and that's not fact-based, right? You know, faith is faith. It's not fact. And cultural, long-standing, ingrained cultural ideas, well, they're not usually fact-based either, but they do factor in, don't they? And you need to acknowledge that and understand it, and as quite a few people are saying, work around it. I like to say work with it. Not around it, because you can't really get out, but you can work with it by acknowledging it, understanding how it impacts the discussion, and being respectful of other people's culture and faith. It's a matter of respect. And, you know, a lot of people, and this is probably true, I've got Melanie and Anthony and Brian and several other people, and they are saying that you, when you get down to the core fundamental beliefs and the core issues, not the just the outside ones, but the real deep down what we're doing, who we are, and why type issues, that all people are more similar than they think they are. And usually more similar to the other is how Anthony puts it. And it's a lack of appreciation and application of the core fundamentals will help. Because at the core, right, is the common goal. The common goal that we need to reach accord on. See? And, you know, Reggie and quite a few others are saying that really the parenting trait that we are talking about with our patience and our tolerance is that we're really acting like, as the host, we are rather like a referee, like a parent resolving a sibling dispute, right? That's like being a referee. You have the two sides, and you get in the middle, and you try to end the dispute, hopefully, before it really gets violent, and before it gets really blown out of proportion. And Hedda says that you need to remember to treat all the sides with equal consideration and fairness. Yes, this is extremely important. And you know, this is a very good point. You have to treat all the sides with consideration and fairness. And Gary and several others have make a very good point that it's important to have not only actual fairness and consideration, but also you have to have the appearance of impartiality. Not only do you have to be fair, people have to know that you're being fair. You have to look fair. You have to seem fair. You have to tell people. I usually actually, as host, I'm not the judge like in a courtroom. And I usually tell people why I think something or why I'm kind of come to a decision on something so that they understand that they've been treated fairly and that all sides are being given equal consideration. And that really is, that goes to the appearance of impartiality, doesn't it? It goes to how you look, how you seem, how people perceive they are being treated. And, you know, quite a few people are asking this, and I suppose it's true. They're asking if the goal is to prevent actual fighting so that you don't actually have to act as a referee. They're thinking of a referee in more of a jump in the middle of a fight, isn't this true, and make the participants go to each side of the ring, so to speak. And I must confess I wasn't thinking of it, and I don't think a lot of us were, in that rather literal way. We're thinking of it more in the resolving of dispute way. And if you think of it is the resolving of dispute, then hopefully you're going to not reach the actual physical altercation idea that needs a referee. And a lot of people are asking, how do you do that? How do you do the referee and keep people from getting really mean and nasty and like and maybe even I see a lot of you have had instances where there have been physical altercations. Well, our goal, right, is to not reach that state, not reach the point where we actually have fisticuffs, right? And so the answer is, the question is how? How are we going to do that? And I thank you for all your participation. I have quite a few people giving suggestions. And a lot of people are going for the time out. And that's where the food comes in, right? Because you can't just call a time out and send adults to corners of the room. It's not going to work. You have to hold a time out that's got something good, like treats, like a party, like networking, like the ability to go outside and take a plate of food with you and think things through, even if you don't physically go outside, but kind of give everyone a breather and let the tempers cool. So that's, yeah, people are saying they make frequent breaks for food in the bathroom and using the phone and like that. You know what? This is interesting. I have quite a few people voting different ways on the idea of using an adult beverage at the meetings, like beer or wine. Now, I do not ever, let's think about this. No, I don't think I ever have. I don't go for adult beverages that are stronger than that because you don't want people to get, well, inebriated so that they can't negotiate, so that they can't think straight. So beer and wine, I have quite a few people that, because, you know, it swings both ways. We've got a lot of people saying that they use beer and wine at the gathering because it makes everybody more, for lack of a better word, loquacious, makes everyone more willing, makes everyone happier. So they go for the libation, the beer or wine, during the meal portion, and everybody comes back and they're all satisfied. And then I have other people that say that you should never use beer or wine because it just makes people unable to focus, essentially speaking. And people are asking what I do. It depends. Oh, you knew I'd say that. I do indeed frequently serve wine. I find that it makes for a more adult, more genteel adult gathering, and I must confess it's a better party, and it keeps people coming back and staying to discuss what needs to be discussed. There are a lot of religious prohibitions against alcohol and a lot of personal ones. It depends on your group. It depends on whether you have confidence that the people in the group will not get inebriated. I mean, you can get inebriated on wine, too. It just takes a little bit longer. And whether or not you think that it will make a more convivial atmosphere, and therefore you'll be able to go forward better. I do not have an opinion against wine, per se. I see a lot of you do. A lot of you are saying that you wouldn't use it under any circumstances. You know, that is a judgment call. It's a judgment call with your attendees, if you know who they are in advance. It makes for a more convivial atmosphere. It could not, though. It's a real good point that it swings both ways. And a lot of people use a warning sound when things are getting kind of out of hand. Like a warning. Okay. We have, Nolan says he uses a whistle. And we've got quite a few people voting for whistle. And Betty has a gong. And we've got those little xylophones that you hold in your hand that you hit and make a little, well, it's kind of a pleasant noise, a little tune. And then Daniel says that he used, and several other people have mentioned, the use of music it's some sort of a, the trick is to use some sort of a physical sound to get people's attention. And quite frankly, usually that means that someone needs to back off. It's a helpful thing. And you know what we always say is that there are really no rules about what you must do. It's whatever works. And you think about your group and about the issues and about what you think will work. And you take it from there. And, you know, we've got another parenting trait that we all could use, and it's different than the ones that we've been talking about because it is the parenting trait that you must be willing to teach. You must be willing to teach. To teach tolerance, to teach focus, to teach networking, although it's a rather overused word, networking, but not in the business sense, in the we can do this together because we can form a team type sense. Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to teach these things. Mm-hmm. Oh, here's an interesting point. Janice says in addition, the teaching is more literal than I thought it was, and you need to be able to research the issues from all sides and present findings and recommendations to the group as a whole. Research the issues from all sides and present findings and recommendations to the group as a whole. Yes, that's a very good point. The teaching might be teaching of the issues, and it is not your job or my job to take on all the responsibility for education on what needs to be done. Pardon me, you can delegate authority like that. Marie says something interesting. She's disagreeing with me. And it's a very good point. Marie says that the host, us, that we are not the teacher. The host is not the teacher. The responsibility of those promoting a solution to research the issues and report to the group. Pardon me. That is a very good point. Pardon me, just took a sip of water there. It is that the host is not responsible for teaching about the issues and things. Those who are promoting an idea, an opinion, an action that needs to be taken are the ones that need to teach about it and say why. Come to the group and explain it to us. So that's a good point. We are all the teachers. And Grace and other people are agreeing that everyone is a teacher of their viewpoint. And then we've got quite a few people, and Stephen and others, and thank you for your participation, who are saying that you need to delegate the responsibility of the teaching. You need to delegate the responsibility of the research, of coming with, well, facts that we talked about at the beginning of this show that show one side or another so we can judge. We are all the teacher, and we are all the judge in that respect. It's an interesting way of looking at it. And, you know, here is, several people are saying this, and this is a really an interesting idea. And I have done this before, and it really works out very well if people sincerely buy into the process. If people will do it, it depends, right? It depends on your group and on the people. But if the people will seriously take this on, this is a very interesting exercise. Thank you, Frank, for mentioning it, because I didn't think of it in the context of teacher. But he says that the people who are promoting an issue are not the only ones that need to do research on it. They are not the only teacher, so to speak. He says that you delegate people to research the other side's viewpoint instead of their own and to argue for it. Well, what an idea. We know what it is that our viewpoint is and why we hold it. But we don't understand why the other people hold their viewpoint. It might not be directly in adverse to us, in contrast, but it's a little different, and we just don't understand why that could be. How'd you come by that? And Frank and others are saying that that's where you have you delegate people to research the other side's viewpoint and argue for it. You know, that's going to create empathy because you'll know something about the other people and why they think that. You're going to get empathy even if you don't get agreement. You know, the idea is not to sway people's viewpoint, to make them give up their long-cherished beliefs. That's not our idea, is it? Our idea is to reach accord with us on this issue and work together so that we can all get a betterment, a common good. And if we don't work together and we get really stubborn, we will not get the common good. You see? That's really the purpose, is to not really change people's minds so much. It's the empathy. You see? It's the empathy of, do we all know the expression? I know this show is global, so I worry that I'm giving American idioms. But to walk in another's shoes, well, that's an interesting point about research and about who should present somebody who walked in another's shoes and really looked at what it is that is driving their opinion. Which will make for wonderful conversation. And no one's patience will be tried because it'll be interesting. And everybody will find that fascinating. Yes. So, now that we've solved that, yes. And of course, it depends on your group and depends on the issues. But we really do use parenting skills, don't we? And so now we've come to the recipe portion of the show. Yes, people are typing in recipe, question mark. Yes, we have. And I know that a lot of you are returning listeners. Thank you very much for coming. And a lot of you are new listeners. Thank you very much for coming also. Wonderful. And the thing that we always say, that I always say, at this juncture in the show, I need to say it every time because it's very important. If you're going to have people coming with food or even catered food, you need to ahead of time warn whoever it is that's bringing it to label it. Not just label it, what is it, like goulash. No, you need to label what is in it because people have allergic reactions to things. People have religious prohibitions, and they have dietary prohibitions. And you don't want to have somebody accidentally eat something at our meeting so that we can get a cord that will adversely affect them. You don't want them to be sick or feel that their faith has been breached, angry, or hurt in any way. It's supposed to be a wonderful, life-affirming, we can do this type meeting. And you sure don't want to make anybody sick or unhappy. So, everything must be labeled, including the condiments that are put in things. you know, you think of some of those things as like a condiment, but if it's been mixed in, it needs to be told, like ketchup or capers or something like that. Okay, and now, those of you who are returning also know that I think that the host should have some extra food because it's something that most people can eat, and you know who's coming and what their likes are because you have emailed ahead of time and asked if anyone has an allergy, a religious prohibition for food, or a dietary prohibition. So you're going to know these things. Yes, you are. And you're going to tell them to everyone so that they don't accidentally bring something that will make someone sick. And now, I usually have two recipes. One of them I call a safe recipe. And I think a safe recipe is one where the ingredients are fairly straightforward and doesn't usually have something that people can't eat. It would be somewhat unusual not to eat this, but we're going to label it anyway, right? Right, because it's very important. And we're going to start with our spicy vegetable couscous, which I think is our safe recipe today. You know, of course, that you make it less spicy depending on who are your participants, or more spicy, or you can leave some spice out for people to judge, to decide what they want. So first of all, we're going to make the couscous, right? We're going to have about 2.5, well, make it 3 cups of couscous. I like it to be nice and thick. And 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and quite a bit of butter, like 1/4 cup of butter. And we're going to cook the couscous, right? We're going to bring it to a boil. We're going to do whatever it says on the box, if we've got a box to it. But you know, you bring it to a boil, kind of like pasta. And you put a little oil in it sometimes to keep it from sticking. And you allow it to puff up like rice or like pasta. And then you drain it, if it needs to be drained. And then you add the butter, and you heat it through and stir it to separate it all out, right? Right. Yes. If you don't like, I'm already getting some questions. You know, if on any of these recipes, and I know I say it a lot, you want to substitute something, go for it. It's kind of like the fact that I say that I use chicken a lot as a protein because I'm in the United States, but this is a global show. Chicken is cheap here and easy to come by. If you have something that's a favorite meat, a favorite food, people are asking about rice, yes, of course, use rice, use pasta, use anything that you think that everyone will like and that is readily available to you, of course. I actually, and we know that I've said this before, I actually like to not put the dish, the stew or whatever it is you're making on top of the pasta, the rice, the couscous, whatever you've got. I like to serve it on the side and then people can decide how much they'd like. And it also keeps it from getting kind of soggy. You know, it kind of absorbs everything and it may not be as good. So we've got the couscous made, right? Right. And now we're going to make our lovely vegetables. We're going to have about 3 tablespoons of olive oil, a nice large onion that we're going to finely chop, 2 garlic cloves that we're going to crush. I'm going to give them a nice crush. And people say I use a lot of garlic. Modify these things if you think it's too spicy. 1 tablespoon of tomato paste. If you don't have the paste, it's tomato puree, yes. About a teaspoon of ground coriander and 1 teaspoon of ground cumin. And then I like 2 cups of the cauliflower tops. I think they're called florets, aren't they? Not the stems, the cauliflower. You can use broccoli if you think that that's prettier and it's easier to come by. You know, modify the vegetables as you see it. About 1/2 pound of carrots that we're going to slice thick. I've seen these kind of dishes with those little bitty carrots. In the States, they come in a bag, and they're kind of tasteless. So I always like to take big carrots and chop them into big, thick, to nice size, not slices, not real thin, not using a one of those slicers. Yeah, just use a knife. And so we got the carrots, about half pound of carrots. And I do like to use bell pepper in everything, don't I? A nice red pepper that we're going to seed and core and dice up. And about half a pound of zucchini, those long, thin squashes that we're going to slice. A fairly big can of like a 16-ounce can of chickpeas that we're going to drain. And I like to rinse them. Pardon me. I like to rinse them because it gets the little shells off. And then you don't have those little shells all over the place. So we're going to drain and rinse the chickpeas. Yes, you can use fresh ones if you're a finer person than I am. You know, of course, that you soak any kind of beans like that. You soak overnight so that makes them softer. Pardon me. And we're going to have about four nice big tomatoes that we're going to peel and slice. If you're going to use canned tomatoes, like the chunk can, not those really squished ones, give them a nice drain so that they don't make the whole thing watery. Let's have 3 tablespoons of chopped cilantro also, because it makes it look lovely and it gives it a nice taste. Okay, so we're going to heat 2 tablespoons of the oil in a really large pan. And we're going to get the onions and the garlic, and we're going to cook them until they're nice and soft, and they smell nice and sliced and translucent. We're going to stir in the tomato paste, the coriander, and the cumin, and we're going to stir that all around and cook it for a couple of minutes. Whole thing gets hot, and it smells wonderful. In fact, this is the kind of thing that you can make in a group if you think it'll be good for the group to do something together. Because it's got a lot of chopping and stuff involved, but it's not very complicated, and it smells wonderful. So we've got the onions and the garlic and the spices and like that, and they're all cooked up in the tomato paste. So now we're going to add the cauliflower, just the tops, right? We're going to cut them into little, not real huge pieces, the carrots and the pepper, and we're going to give it enough water to come about halfway up the vegetables. And we're going to give this whole thing a nice boil. And we're going to cook it for about 5-10 minutes until everything is firm but cooked through so that it's not hard as a rock, right? And now we're going to add the sliced squash, the zucchini, the chickpeas, and the tomatoes and cook it for another 5 minutes or so. And then we're going to stir in the coriander. And we're going to lower the whole thing. And it's still got some water to it, right? We're going to simmer it over a low heat so that all the flavor melds and the vegetables are a nice, I'd call it al dente if it was pasta, but a nice consistency. Not mushy, but solid, but easy to eat and delicious. So we're going to simmer the whole thing for a little while. We're going to give it a poke with a fork and see that it is really done. And then we're going to spoon it over our couscous, our pasta, our rice, whatever it is that we've decided that we want as our underneath. If we are serving this potluck, which we usually are, I usually leave the starch, we'll call it, in a big bowl separate next to the vegetarian entree, the spiced vegetarian. Can we call it a stew? I suppose we can call it a stew. So that's that. It's easy to do. It's not, doesn't have a lot of secret ingredients that most people are allergic, have a religious prohibition or dietary prohibition from, but we're going to label it anyway. So that's my safe recipe. It smells lovely, and of course you make it more or less in amounts, depending on how many people you think you're going to have. Yes. And you substitute all kinds of vegetables. The trick is to make the lovely spice mixture and to get the vegetables to a nice, looks nice on the plate, but is cooked through consistency. Yes, yes. And it's very popular, and people really like it. And it's vegetarian, which is nice if you have some people that are vegetarians. Yes. Okay, and now we're going to go on to our adventure recipe. And it's an adventure recipe because it has several things that quite a few people don't eat. And you need to label it very carefully, and you need to have an idea of what kind of prohibitions you've got. It has sausage, which is pork, usually. And it has some wine to it. You can modify this however you want, and you can get rid of the sausage. Well, it won't, well, it's really a sausage bread pudding. But you could use a chicken sausage, for example, or something that didn't have pork, if people had a prohibition against it. That's usually a religious or a dietary prohibition. Anyway, so here we go. It's an unusual dish. It's a sausage bread pudding. It's a savory bread pudding. You usually think of bread pudding as kind of a sweet dessert thing with raisins in it. And I usually put, as the host, I usually do more of an entree item, don't we, as the items that we're bringing. A lot of people bring a dessert. You won't be bereft of dessert. There's always someone who'll bring a nice cake. But an entree type dish is one that we're going to provide. So this is a sausage bread pudding. So here we go. We're going to have about a pound of sausage. I like Italian sausage just because it's not tremendously spicy, but it's got a nice taste to it. And I take, if it's got a casing, I slit off the casing and I chop up the meat. Some sausage has a casing, some doesn't. In the United States, in the U.S. you don't always see a really thick casing that you need to remove. But if you've got such a thing, you take it off before you chop the meat. We all know that. Yes, yes. And we're going to have about we're going to mince up a nice medium-sized onion till we have, about half a cup of minced onion. That's kind of a large onion in order to do that. Yes. And we're going to take some green peppers. You can have red peppers too. Green is a little more savory than red. Then the yellow ones are kind of like the red ones, right? Right. I like to have a green pepper for this. And I seed it and I core it. And I also mince that up real small. And we're going to have a half a cup of dry white wine. Now, we can leave out the dry white wine. But, of course, we have to substitute something for the liquid. And if you're going to substitute something, use stock and not water, right? And so we're going to have white wine. Use a beef stock if you've got it, instead of the white wine if you must. Although the wine gives it a real nice depth to the flavor. And now, here's what makes it the bread pudding, right? We're going to have about 8 cups of cubes of day-old bread. The kind of bread that is dense, like a French bread or an Italian loaf or something. If you use the mushy commercial stuff or a whole wheat or something like that, it will not be the same. You need a dense stale bread. I say that and people ask how stale, and people are asking that. And the answer is, don't use it if it's really got mold or something. We're feeding people. You're eating it yourself. You want something that's like a day old. It's just gotten a little bit hard. And people are saying you can toast it up a little bit if you don't have any. And that's the truth, too. If it's a really dense bread, like a sourdough or something really dense, it doesn't even have to be day old. You can just use it. So anyway, we're going to cube it up. We're going to make nice chunks out of it. About 8 cups. We're going to use a lot. There's going to be quite a bit of bread. And then we're going to have 2.5 cups of whole milk. Don't use skim. A half cup of heavy cream. About 1/4 cup of melted butter. We're going to beat 8 large eggs. We're going to have 1/2 pound of provolone cheese, grated or shredded. It comes shredded here in bags, which is kind of convenient. And we're going to have a half pound of cheddar cheese, also shredded. A little bit of salt. And a little bit of pepper to taste, as they say. And about a half cup of grated Parmesan cheese. So we've got a lot of good ingredients. We've got several ingredients that are that may have prohibitions, which is what makes this our adventure recipe. And you have to ask first, right? Right. So we're going to preheat the oven to 350. And then we're going to get ourselves one of our nice big skillets. Oops. I'm sorry. I went oops because I dropped something. Excuse me. And we're going to heat the skillet over medium heat and get it hot, right? And then we're going to put the sausage in it because it's all going to sizzle. And it's going to get golden brown and makes delicious because it's all chopped up, right? And we've taken the casings off it. And when we've got the pan all full of sausage and sausage oil, sausage fat really is what it really is, we're going to add the onions and the bell peppers. And we're going to make them until they're also translucent and soft, right? The pepper's soft, the onion's translucent. And then we're going to add the white wine, and we're going to stir it around over the high heat to reduce it somewhat. So we're going to stir this whole thing and kind of reduce the wine. And so now we've got that going, right? Right. We're going to set it aside. We're going to place our bread. You know, actually, you could do the bread first, come to think of it. I usually do. Oops. I usually do this bread thing first. So you do the skillet with the onions and the peppers and the sausages and like that. While that's being cooked, we can say it that way, you stick the bread in a really big mixing bowl. But I like it to be, I don't know how to describe this. It's not a mixing bowl with real high sides. It's kind of it's really a pan, really. We're going to call this, kind of a wide mixing bowl, because you don't want the bread to be just high. You want it to be spread out a little bit, because we're going to soak it in the milk and the cream is what we're doing. We're going to take the bread cubes, and we're going to add the milk and the cream, and you're going to stir it all over so that it gets permeated, so you don't have some bread cubes that are dry and some that are squish. So you want to mix it real well, kind of fast, and you let that stand for about 5 minutes, which is why I said, really, I let the bread stand for 5 minutes while I'm making the sausage and the onions. And we're going to grease up a nice casserole dish, like a rectangular one, about 9 by 13. And we're going to coat it all over with the butter. And we're going to after we coat with the butter, remember we've got quite a bit of butter. We've got, about a quarter of a cup of butter? We coated all the sides and everything so it can get out. Whatever's left over, I throw into the bread mixture. So now we've got the pan with the sausage mixture and the pan with the bread mixture. We're going to mix them. We're going to mix them in the big bowl, and then we're going to add the beaten eggs, the grated cheeses, and a little salt and pepper, and we're going to kind of stir it, mix it together without making the bread go to squish. So mix it kind of gently. And we're going to put it in the casserole dish. I like to cover this because it kind of steams it. If you've got a pan for your casserole dish, I don't actually have a pan, so I use aluminum foil. But you cover it with something, and then bake it for about an hour. And then you uncover it, and you bake it for another 15 minutes because you want the top to be brown. And then I usually take the Parmesan cheese, and when the top is semi-brown, I put all the Parmesan cheese, I sprinkle it over the top, and then I give it another 15 minutes in the oven so that it's all browned on top with the Parmesan cheese, which also makes a nice crust. So, it's delicious. It's wonderful, and of course, it can be rewarmed when you get there. But don't just leave it out someplace forever because, of course, it's got some perishable items in it. You know, it may make sick. But anyway, we've got a sausage bread pudding. You cut it up, you leave a spoon out or a knife, you cut it into pieces. Delicious. Everybody likes it, but it does have some ingredients that some people are unable to eat. So it has to be labeled carefully, and you can't really see what's in it either, which is what makes it the adventure recipe. But it's delicious, and also I always say when you have a casserole or a bread pudding like this, that when you take it out of the oven, before you set it out to be cut, I think it should sit. I think it should, what they call, let stand. I think it should sit for about 5 minutes anyhow. Not a long time. It's very, very hot, so it's not a problem. But it should sit and kind of get firm before you send it out to be cut. So if you can, let it sit for a minute. Anyway, we are now to the end of our show. Thank you very much for listening. And I hope to see you again. Thank you. Bye-bye.